friends. As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is the problem of ethics. Light and darkness are the world's eternal ways, says the Gita. That there has always been pairs of opposites in the world. If there are rebels, then on the other hand there are God-fearing people. If there are abiders of the law, then there are also the lawbreakers. We have Kamsa for Krishna. We had Ravana against Rama. One of them was the preserver of cosmic order, the other was disruptor of the cosmic order. So we can see that the problem of erosion of ethics, as it were, is a very old thing. But what is really, what is alarming today is the unprecedented increase in the unethical practices. We can say that the cancer of immorality has spread to almost all the fields. It's not just social evils that we talk about. We can see that the erosion of ethics of immorality is to be seen even in education, in sports, in business, also in science and scientific research. And as the first speaker pointed out, you can see that today we find these ethical problems, the moral problems, are so complex that it's difficult to decide whether it is moral or immoral. What would you call as moral and what would you call as immoral? Especially this is so in science. Today science is investigating, say, genetic engineering is a field, cloning, stem cell research, and we wonder, even though it talks about doing all these for the benefit of humanity, just 2 or 3 years back, we were told that science is trying to graft the brain cells of human beings into monkeys. This was all done for trying to get an insight into Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. And yet, there was severe criticism coming from the scientific community itself. There were many scientists who felt that, well, we are blurring the line between man and animal. Some of the researchers felt, some of the people felt that researchers are overstepping the boundaries of morality, which we need to define. And that is important. Who is going to define this moral boundary? Because it is not at all easy. Earlier days, when they used to do research and there was vivisection, we could very easily say that you are torturing animals, you are killing animals in order to make, say, some sort of a medicine or find out ways and means of curing certain human diseases, for improving human conditions. But you have no right to kill animals because you don't have power to give them life. Professor C.S. Lewis, he wrote that if you are saying that it is all for human betterment, then first of all, live that sort of a life which will justify torturing of the animals. Do we really live that sort of a superior life where we can justify the torturing and killing of hundreds of guinea pigs or rats or monkeys? We have to first show that kind of quality of living to justify vivisection. But today we find that all that they are doing is take out a few cells from the fetus and then experiment. All that they are doing is maybe bringing about mutation of the gene. Now, will we call that? On what ground are we going to call it as immoral? Though people like the head of the Sun Microsystem, Bill Joy, he pointed out the dangers of this kind of a knowledge. He said that, look, earlier days when there was atomic bomb, once the atomic bomb is made, and first of all, not everybody is going to have paraphernalia required for making an atomic bomb. And once you explode, that is all. But here, you are tampering with matter at the atomic level, that is nanotechnology. You are changing a gene, and once it is mutated, once it is changed, it replicates itself and it goes out of hand. So once that the modification has happened, it's going to just go on and on. So this knowledge is dangerous. But even he is not able to point out and say, this is moral or immoral. We may ask questions. Do ends justify the means? We may say, we are interfering with the natural processes. We are interfering with nature. But are we having cut and dried answers to these questions? We don't. So though we talk about universal ethics, universal morality, which are true at all times, at all places, we say that there is nothing like Hindu ethics distinct from Muslim ethics. There is nothing like business ethics separate from ethics of education and sports. When it comes to making the application of ethics to a specific field, we can see that a lot of ingenuity, a lot of reflection is required before we can say what is moral and what is immoral. Another problem of ethics in our days is that it is extremely difficult to practice ethics in Kali Yuga. As the name suggests, it is Kali Yuga, Kali. It's a dark age, it's Iron Age, which is supposed to be the fourth Yuga in the order of decline of morality. In one of the Upanishads, the righteousness or morality is depicted as an animal having four legs. So they say that in the Satya Yuga, this animal, righteousness, it stood on all the four legs. Then in Silver Age, it stood on three legs. In Bronze Age, it stood on two legs. And now in Kali Yuga, it's barely managing to stand on one leg. There is decline of morality, and therefore we find it exceedingly difficult to practice and be moral in the world where we think everybody is selfish, everybody is mean and immoral. It's like asking a person to walk 10 miles distance on a hot summer afternoon. It will call for a greater effort and it will be tiring as compared to walking 10 mile distance on a wintry day. You know, it's the same difference. Ask someone to be moral when everyone around is good and nice, and ask someone to be good when everybody around is trying to be mean and being self-centered and so on. Now, this being the thing, we always say, what can you do? And the answer is, you cannot do much against Kali Yuga, but you can do much in it. The very rate of vibration is four times greater in Kali Yuga. So anything you do, your results are going to come back to you quick. And therefore, there is always a greater chance of making progress. Because after all, you are acting against all odds. You are trying to be good when so many others around are not being good. And yet, it is not as if everybody is selfish, everybody is immoral. It's the problem is that the morality of the people doesn't get showcased in the modern parlance. It is not getting highlighted enough. You read newspapers, you read magazines, and we always complain, it's full of news about murders and rapes and theft and things like that. But very rarely, now and then you have a column like City of Angels where you get highlighted the morality and goodness of the people. And that is why it's very disheartening for us. We feel the world is all bad, but that is not so. And that's why in the very first quotation, HPB points out this characteristic of our civilization when she says, our civilization built up of shams and appearances is at best like a beautiful green morass, a bog spread over a deadly quagmire. Because this century of culture and worship of matter, while offering prizes and premiums for every best thing under the sun, from the biggest baby and the largest orchid down to the strongest pugilist and the fattest pig, has no encouragement to offer to morality, no prize to give for any moral virtue. So this recognition of honesty and morality is very less in our days. As we said, it's not highlighted. But the very fact that now and then we see people, we have first-hand experience of people of being honest and morally pure, shows that it is not impossible even in these circumstances. It shows that therefore we should not be blaming our surroundings and say that how can you be pure in such a surrounding and such an atmosphere. As HPB says that no doubt by changing the environment of the organism, you can alter the organism, but that is not the whole of the story. Because more important is what is the attitude of the organism to the atmosphere. That is something we have to take into account. Often we find that it's a person who comes from the poor section and disadvantaged section of the society, he turns out to be more honest and pure as compared to a person who has lived his life in luxury and comforts. How is it that a sweeper in our office, and this is by the way a real incident, on finding a purse containing 50,000 rupees, returns it to the owner without removing a single note? Whereas the officer in the same office, who earns perhaps five times greater salary than the sweeper, is always looking out for ways and means of earning extra bucks. by fair means or foul. Now, therefore, we can see that it's a question of opening the chink in the armor. That's what Buddha says in the next quotation. He whose hand has no wound may touch poison. Poison harms not one who has no wound. No evil is to him who does no evil. So it's a question of our own attitude. And also we find on the other hand that none of us is all that completely fortified or invulnerable. You know, we talk about opening the chink in the armor. But none of us is completely fortified, because after all, each of us has got his own weak spot, his own Achilles' heel. We have to identify that weak spot in us. For some, it could be lust for money. For some, it could be lust for sex. For another, it could be lust for fame and power. For some, it could be ridiculously love for food. Excessive love for food, it's his weak spot. So, when we are trying to practice morality, we've got to first identify which is that spot on which I'm likely to be hit. Nature can test me there. And I could be put into such a situation where I can be tempted and tested. So I need to be especially careful on that ground or on that ground. Sangha Rakshita gives the example of a monk who used to be, quite fond of, excessively fond of plum cakes. To the extent that he says, you can get anything done from this monk if you offered him a piece of plum cake. He would be bought over by this plum cake. Now what should he do? And he says that, first of all, restrain in the senses, as they say. It's not the ultimate. But this monk should not go near the places where the plum cakes are being cooked, plum cakes are being stored, plum cakes are being sold. He should try and avoid at least going to these tempting places, which can tempt him in a big way. But meanwhile, of course, whenever there is someone offering, there are smaller temptations which he should try and override and overcome. Building up the inner strength all the while. Probably this is something which we can practice with a weak spot where we are ethically, morally going to be tried. And of course, it's not going to be easy. That we must always bear in mind. When people around, if they are all taking bribes, then it's going to be very difficult for us not to take bribes. And yet, we can do it. We can summon up that enough moral courage within us and remain untainted even in the atmosphere when everybody is taking bribe, at the price that you can be taunted, you can be isolated, you can be persecuted by those who are not, they are interested in taking bribe and you aren't. But it is possible to remain clean, as our reading says, from a heap of rubbish on the roadside, a lily blooms. That you can remain untainted even in a tainted atmosphere. Also, self-reform is what precedes and must precede the world reform. Because the germ of everything that we find in the world around us, the germs of all those things, dishonesty, lying, sexual perversion, be sure they are there in you also. And therefore, let us not feel that, it's the world which is like that and not me. So first try and tackle that. Just today, I think Times Life is carrying a very insightful little piece of writing based on what just recently happened with the CEO of the Penguin, CEO of Penguin Canada. Yeah, we won't give the names, but this is a person who was accused of sexual harassment of his colleague. And interestingly, all those women colleagues who have ever worked with him, they could vouch for his pureness. They said, he's a thorough gentleman. He is a very decent guy. And only after a few days, he himself confessed to having consensual relationship with that particular colleague. And then everyone was silent. So the point the writer is making is that never can you be so sure as to the deepest and darkest urges in the person you know right from your childhood. You can never be very sure of the deepest and darkest urges in your own self. What we are trying to say is that the germs are there. They are waiting only for the right conditions. Sometimes it is a momentary madness that instantly you just all the good sense is thrown away and you just fall a prey. So always we need to be on the guard and never feel that you don't have it in you. When you feel that there is this kind of people are taking bribe and so on and I don't have, well, not in a weak way. Ask yourself a question, what is my desire for wealth like? If tomorrow somebody comes to me and offers me a large sum of money and says, just keep it, nobody will know about it, will I keep it? Will I really try and find out whether it is earned by fair means or unfair means? Am I insisting upon earning my living by fair means, even if I have a huge family to support? These are the questions which will really settle the matter for us. How much of the greed is there in us? Also, we must nip the evil in the bud. The example which is often given is that many, many years back, when the builders used to ask for black money, the amount involved was very small. But as the years passed, it was 10%, it was 20%, and today you find that 60, 70, some of them want everything in the black and nothing in white. So, before it goes out of proportion, it should be nipped in the bud. In the name of creating liberal, broad-minded society, we have the evil of unwed mothers, evil of extramarital affair, homosexuality, gay communities, lesbianism. And the irony is that we dare not speak openly about these things. Today there are people who will oppose and say, what's wrong with it? In fact, homosexuality and lesbianism, well, it has got legal sanction now. Society has given a tacit permission and sanction to these things. So, again, one doesn't know on what grounds would we call it moral, on what grounds will we call it immoral, and yet we find that life is a great taskmaster and a great teacher. Nature will not tolerate any transgression in any of her departments, and she will let her fury, and it comes in terms of incurable diseases like AIDS. It comes in terms of earthquakes, tsunamis, tornadoes and what have you. Now, the other problem which comes these days is that if everybody is not really caring so much for morals, what difference does it make if I am moral or immoral? What difference can one individual make? And yet we know that we say that not a single example of righteous living is ever wasted. You are setting an example of your life to other people in the family, other people maybe in the neighborhood, in the office. So not a single example of righteous living is wasted. And something happens on the inner planes, about which we shall see. There is the story about a grocer who used to cheat people. He had scales which were tempered with, they were faulty scales. And in fact, he was having a spare faulty scale to be used in emergencies. So, one day as it happened, the vegetable vendor in the vicinity knew that he keeps one spare scale. So he approaches because his scale had broken. He comes to the grocer and says, can you lend me your scale? And he takes it. Now, as it happens, the wife of the grocer always buys vegetables from that vegetable vendor. So for 10 days, he keeps the scales and the wife comes home and tells the husband, I think this guy is cheating us. Last 10 days I have been observing, he is giving us less vegetables. And when the grocer asks, who is the vegetable vendor? And when he comes to know, he has to confess that, look, he has borrowed our scales. And you know, I use faulty scales, so we are getting less vegetables now. Simple implication of the tale is that by what measure you met unto others, by that same measure it will be measured unto you again. But there is a far greater implication. This we can say is a concrete example of something which happens on the inner planes. We say we are united on the inner planes. And therefore, on the inner planes, we don't know. But we are either helping or hindering other human beings in either hindering or helping in building their character for good or for bad through our thoughts. So if I become a little lazy and say that I'm not going to resist the temptation of telling a lie, or I'm not going to resist the temptation of, say, taking this bribe, or just allow any old thoughts of sensuality material gain to come in my mind, to that extent, we are told that you give that kind of a push or a negative push to the other person who is similarly fighting like you with that kind of weaknesses in his nature. But the converse is also true, that if you try very hard and are determined to not give in to the temptation of taking bribe or telling lie, or don't allow any negative thoughts or sensuous thoughts to enter your mind, to that extent, you will give a positive push to that man who is on the borderline of whether to do it or not, and you will be helping him, enabling him to make a right choice. And that is what Mr. Jack says in these letters that have helped me, that we attract what we love, and we may derive a greater strength from the vitality of thoughts infused from without than from those self-produced within us at a time when our nervous vitality is exhausted. That maybe otherwise you are very firm, but when you are, as they say, in your weaker moments, when you are down, at that time, likelihood is that you will derive more vitality from thoughts which are infused from outside than the self-produced thoughts. It is a solemn thought, this, of our responsibility for the impulse of another. We live in one another, and our widely different deeds have often a common source. So, H.P.B. therefore says that every one of us is like a cell in the body. And if one cell is unhealthy, then it can produce disease in the entire body. And that's why she takes the whole thing on a much higher level, saying, no man can rise superior to his individual failings without lifting, be it ever so little, the whole body of which he is an integral part. In the same way, no one can sin nor suffer the effects of the sin alone. But of course, though the individual morality must precede the worldly form, there are times, there are situations where, as a parent of the family, as the elder, or as the person who is the head in the institution, head of the nation, you may want to bring about reform in the people. There are also people who are dedicated to bringing about social reforms, political reforms. Then again, we must know, how should we go about it? What Theosophy says is that for bringing about these reforms, you must start from within without. Try and change the mind and hearts of people. It cannot be done by force. It cannot be done by imposing of the laws. And therefore, what Professor Lewis says is that you cannot have a good society without good men, but you cannot have good men simply by imposing of the laws. Because if you have laws, but if the people remain the same old bullying, twisting, cheaters, they will continue to cheat, they will continue to evade taxes. Huh? You have very, very stringent laws, but some intelligent mind will find a loophole in that law, twist it, turn it, and he will do what he is doing. So, humorously they say that we have the 10 commandments, but if there was an 11th commandment which said, thou shalt not be found out, then nobody will care to follow the 10th commandments. Why? Because we have not really recognized the value. This is the thing. We have to, before we try and reform people, first make them see why they need to do what they are asked to do. So, internal recognition of the value. Once you internally recognize this is true, as Mr. Crosby says, you will always keep your face turned in that direction. The highest authority is man himself. The highest authority is not someone who is the president of the state or who is head of the family. Even to a child, you can first make him recognize that this is the good thing. Then he will automatically do. Otherwise, he will wash his hands because he is scared that the parent will scold. But once the parents are not looking, he will not want to wash his hands before eating the dinner. We can see this happening at all the levels. So internal recognition of the value. First changing the inside and then outside. Imposing of the laws will not do. And that's what is something which Mr. Crosby puts very well in the next quotation, that consider our foolish laws, which seek to make men good by legislation, with no attempt to arouse the real nature of man, but only to repress what is considered bad. Prohibitions of all kinds serve only to exasperate the evil nature in men. We need not to prohibit, we need to educate. And first of all, we need to educate ourselves. Let us follow the lines of the law of our own being, compassion, love, helpfulness for all, and then we shall be able to help leaven the whole lump. No other laws are required. Follow the laws of your own being, compassion, love, and helpfulness for all. And what HPB therefore points out, quoting Dryden, who says, virtue in distress and vice in triumph makes atheists of man. And what does she say? That is because people do not know the laws of karma and reincarnation. In other words, as the first speaker pointed out, we must have a scientific basis for ethics. And the other aspect of ethics is metaphysics. This is not the lecture in which we can get into metaphysics at all. But that is what theosophy tries to provide. Why should you be good? Why should you not find fault? And we are given enough of the metaphysics to understand and push us on to really practice ethics. But more than that, what the masters say is that karma and reincarnation provide sure and logical basis for promulgated ethics. It is karma and rebirth. It is these doctrines which will awaken you to practice ethics. Well, so long as your religion says that it doesn't matter, you have committed sin, you have killed the cat, make a cat of gold, offer it to the deity and your sin will be washed away. So long as your religion says that, all right, you have committed some sin, make a confession to the father and it is wiped out. Deathbed conversions are there. At the dying moment you say, I believe in the blood of Christ. Christ died for all of us. All these things of vicarious atonement and so on and so forth. When you have this idea, naturally who is going to bother? In fact, that section has got right to forgive in the Key to Theosophy. It's an excellent section where HPB brings out this very idea saying that, look, that man by murdering, he did well because after murdering, he makes his confession to the priest and says he believes in the Christ. And the priest says, well, not only your sin is washed, but your place in heaven is assured. He did well. Because the ordinary man is not going to get his place in heaven, but this man by committing murder has got his place. So this is the warped idea we have. So long as we feel that we can get away with everything, or we have the idea that there is only one life, eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow we shall die. So long as this idea is there, there is no incentive to practice ethics. But if you think and if you know that you can't get away from whatever you do, as the often we quote that child from Theosophy School who said, whether you go to the depth of the ocean or you go and hide yourself in the mountain, but karma, the law of karma will find you out. It's an all-seeing law. And don't think that by doing some sort of a ceremony, by offering coconuts or by having some karma kanda, pariharas, you will be able to escape the consequences of karma. At one place, not exactly those words, but HPB says that no yogi or no saint can really interfere with another's karma, and if at all, it's only temporary. So we may say that there may be only postponement of your karmic consequences, maybe by few years or few lives, but that will come back, she says, with tenfold greater force. So we are not going to have an escape from this karma. Sooner or later it will catch up with us, and if that be so, she says, once teach people that greatest of all laws, karma and reincarnation, and besides feeling in themselves the true dignity of human nature, they will turn from evil and eschew it as they would a physical danger. So this is the logical basis for practice of ethics which we are given out. And of course, sometimes you need to just go back to the basic. You know, today we find that lots of immorality. What is at the back of it? At the back of it is greed. So if we were to follow only one injunction of Buddha, contentment is the greatest wealth, we may say that a lot of this immorality may simply vanish. Contentment is the greatest wealth. There's this beautiful story by Leo Tolstoy. It's the story about a person who was very greedy. He had insatiable desire for possessing more and more areas of land. Now his greed leads him to a village, and he meets the village, the elder of the village, who says that, well, all these acres of land which you can see, it can be all yours. All you have to do is, from the sunrise to the sunset, you have to walk and go on walking. And as much land as you can cover by walking will be yours. Of course, the condition was that at the end of the day, by sunset, you should be back at the same spot again. Now the man says, why should I walk? I'll run so that I can even cover a greater area of land. So he begins to run. But by the time the evening approaches, he is anxious. He has to reach back the spot. So he runs even faster. He is breathless. And he collapses by the time he comes to the spot and dies. Now, the villagers see that he needs to be buried. So they measure his body and they dig out a patch of land enough to bury that body. The village elder is looking on and he sighs and says, how much land does a man need? How much land does a man need? 7 feet? That's all that he needed. And this is the thing which we find very much relevant in our days, applicable to our ambitious achievers. Again, today's Times Life carries this article where they say there is midlife crisis occurring at a time which never used to occur before. It used to be at the 45 and 55 years of age that people used to have the midlife crisis of getting into depression, getting heart attacks, stress. Today you find that a guy is a CEO of the company by the time he's 30 or 32, and well, he's achieved all that is to be achieved all too soon. He has a lot of knowledge, he's smart, his IQ is very high, but he is stressed out. He gets severe depression. And worst thing is, he is very poor in his EQ, emotional quotient, so that he can't manage his relationships. He can't manage his personal crisis in life. And this is the tragedy. Why? Because does he really need to have more and more and more? How much land does a man need? And how much wealth does a man need? How many cars does a man need? We can really go on asking these questions. And you know that really, if you just practice contentment, well, a lot of moral problems can get solved out. Now, when we are in a dilemma, we are told that you can consult your conscience, your inner voice, because at times there is not an easy answer to be found in the scriptures. You can consult the inner voice and you find that your inner voice itself, unfortunately, what we call as the voice of conscience, is colored. Colored by centuries of unethical living, people, religion, community, they have done some sort of a brainwashing, they have done some indoctrination, so people felt that, all right, untouchability must be practiced, I am of the high caste. There were English who felt that you can hunt the animals, they don't have any souls, or religious persecutions were taken up, all in the name of God. So this voice of conscience needs to be educated, again, by exposing ourselves to universal ideas, by reading the scriptures and so on. But even when we read the scriptures, I mean, even when we consult the voice, and even when we know what is the moral thing to do, we'll find it's not very easy to really overnight become morally pure. No. Why? Because HPB says in the handout you have on the second page, man is a free agent during his stay on earth. There are external and internal conditions which affect the determination of our will upon our actions. That there are external conditions. There is the pressure of the family. There is the pressure of the society. If today even it's not moral or immoral, today you want to be unambitious, people will say, what? You are just satisfied being a clerk in the office. Don't you want to rise? Don't you want to become someone? See, even there you will find there is a pressure. Leave alone becoming, not taking bribe and things like that. Smallest thing you want to, go in the right direction, there is pressure from the external environment, from the people who don't see the way you do. And there is pressure from the inner environment. Because after all, you have built up certain tendencies in the past. And for some of us, it may be very difficult, say, overthrowing the habit of lying, overthrowing sensuality, overthrowing maybe dishonesty. Why? It's more difficult for one person than the other because he carries these tendencies from the past. Therefore, it must show us that we must not sit on the judgment of another person, especially in this field of morality. If you find someone is stingy, you say, oh, he's a very stingy guy. Don't go to him, he'll never give you money. But have you tried to find out that there is a background to that man? That in this life, maybe he had parents who were stingy, hard, coming from very poor surroundings, so now he feels insecure about money. Maybe there is a background which is coming from the previous lives. And therefore, we may say that it is not really our job to sit down on judging the morality of the people. Generally, we are very impatient with other people, saying that they are incorrigible, they'll never improve. But what HPB says is, all good and evil things in humanity have their roots in human character. And this character is and has been conditioned by the endless chain of cause and effect. This is the thing, endless chain of cause and effect. But this conditioning applies to the future as well as to the present and the past. Selfishness, indifference and brutality can never be the normal state of the race. To believe so would be to despair of humanity, and that no theosophist can. To say that, oh, they are incorrigible and they won't improve, is really giving up on people, and which we should not do. It will take time. And the most important thing is that it is very difficult to judge what is good and what is evil. As the first speaker pointed out, good and evil are relative terms. Of course, no doubt there are universal ethics, for which Immanuel Kant said they are categorical imperatives. There is no ifs and buts about that. When you say universal ethics, you must tell the truth, you must do this, you must do that. These are categorical imperatives. There is no argument about it. You need to practice. But when you try to judge an action to be moral or immoral, you will find it's very difficult to make its application. Scriptures have said there are certain actions which are forbidden. Scriptures have said there are certain actions which are recommended. Like actions of dana, tapas and yagna should never be abandoned by a person. Now take these three things, dana, tapas, yagna, charity, asceticism or mortification and sacrifice. Are we going to say that everybody who gives some money to the poor, he is a moral person, he has committed a very morally pure act? Of course not. Why would Gita actually divide this charity into three parts, calling it sattvic charity, rajasic charity, tamasic charity? Why will it say that there are people who give out large sums of money so that they can have name and fame? Some give out large sums of money so that they can earn merit or punya. Some of them give out money, well, without seeing the worthiness of the person. Even if he is going to go and drink alcohol, just to get rid of him, they will give money indifferently, in contempt, with the expectation of result, with the expectation of having hold over people. Now, would you say that is moral? They are practicing charity, all right. But would you call it a moral act? To what extent is it a moral act? Now, this is one thing. Similarly, take asceticism. Yes, abstaining from certain desires. Having control over certain desires is good. But purely bodily asceticism, where you will fast for many, many days, you will pierce your cheeks, stand on one leg, maybe abstain from many of the things, you want only two pairs of clothes, but you look down upon other people, you have holier-than-thou attitude. Will you say that that man is spiritual and morally pure? Take sacrifice. Similar thing is true about sacrifice, as HPB says, that useless sacrifice is a crime of folly. Where she gives the example of certain Christian missionaries who went to China and who went to the South Sea Islanders to preach Christianity. And he says, in one case they went to people whose own philosophy is so noble, and the other case they went to people who are not yet ripe for receiving truth. And in the process they were killed also. Now was this really a very noble sacrifice which was made? We can go on and on. So, in judging any act, Gita rightly says, all our actions are involved in fault, just like a fire is enveloped by smoke. And therefore, in judging any action, we have to take into account the motive with which the action was done, the inner state of the person, the degree of knowledge and the degree of development of the person, and then we may say to what extent it was a really moral or immoral act. And therefore, very important sentence comes somewhere in the preface to Dhammapada, which says that we must retain ethical awareness but reject categorical morality because it leads to self-righteousness. We must retain ethical awareness. We must know what is ethical, what is non-ethical, what are the panchashilas, dasashilas, all that. But we must reject categorical morality by labeling people flatly, this is right and this is wrong. Because Buddha has given three verses there. Who follows the downward path? Those who see evil in which there is no evil. Those who fear where there is no cause to fear. Those who are ashamed when there is no cause to ashame. All of them, they follow the downward path following false doctrine. Now this is a very subtle thing which we need to keep in mind. Because application of ethics is not a simple thing at all. Sometimes we give a very trivial example which often is given from the platform, that telling the truth, for instance. Now, we give that story of a sage who was sitting and one man who was apparently a robber was running. And behind him, 5-6 people with open sword were actually running after him to catch him. So when they see the sage, they say, have you seen this guy who was just running? And sage says, maybe I think he kept silent, or he didn't say anything, or he said, no, I have not seen. Now, of course, he had seen the man run, but he realized that if I tell them, they will kill the man. In order to save life, therefore, he tells a lie. Now, how are you going to sit down and judge? He should not have told the lie. He should have done this. Now, here we can see that therefore, there is no categorical morality. There is no clear-cut and cut-and-dry application of the ethics. Mr. Judge goes a step further. He looks at it from a completely different and a much higher point of view when in letters that have helped me, he says, well, a person, when he commits murder, we all know there is no two ways about it. It is wrong. But is the act entirely evil? And he says, no. Because sometimes the soul requires evil and suffering in order to make progress. Now this man who committed murder, maybe in the next life he will be born in poor surroundings, maybe he will be born in the most disadvantageous surroundings, and as a result of which there might be the turning of the cog. Then you will find that because of the murder, now this kind of a change has come about in him which otherwise would not have been there. So once again, that murder, yes, in one sense it is wrong, but in another sense, what has happened? It has brought about the change in the man, maybe a radical change in the person. So as a result, he has become a little more soft, he has acquired sympathy, he has acquired courage, he is chastised, and so on and so forth. So also, somewhere in letters that have helped me, Mr. Judge points out that for some people at least, this is the path where they sink deep down and then they rise to proportionately greater heights. This is what is said also in the Through the Gates of Gold, that sometimes your character is charred and burnt and only ashes are left. And from that blackened ashes, phoenix-like, the person rises again. Of course, he says, this is not the highest path to follow, but for some people, this is the path. They sink down. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that's the story of Shantaram. Shantaram, there is a whole novel. It's about the guy who's really gone down the drain. And then suddenly he picks up and he turns to spirituality. And we'll have many, many examples of such people. On the other hand, he says, that other path is the most difficult one, where you walk without much variation, where there is a never-ceasing strain. All the time you have to be careful what I say, what I think, is this right, is this wrong? That is a never-ceasing strain. And who can walk that path? Only the one who has acquired strength by ages of service to humanity. So, When you have lived that kind of a life of helping humanity for ages together, you have that moral stamina to keep up that courage to always choose the right, to always walk on the moral path. But for most of us, therefore, it's slipping down maybe 3 feet and rising up again 2 feet and so on. Now, also, talking about goodness, we may say that it is relatively good, because from the point of view of the people who are on a still higher rung, our ordinary goodness is also not enough. Sometimes, as they say, as HPB says in that article, that one who is trying to live the life of occultism, this competition which our world praises so much, calling it friendly rivalry, is an obstacle. A man who loves his family, his children and wife, and has self-identifying attachment, it's a barrier to occultism. Because although it is a very noble sentiment, which husband will not really sacrifice the pleasures of 100 other women in order to make happy this one woman? Which parent will not disappoint hundreds of children in order to make happy this one child? So long as your heart is occupied with love for few selves, where is there going to be the concern for the whole of humanity? So ultimately, it is non-separateness and universal brotherhood which is going to be the basis for true morality. Now, this is a very tall order. I suppose before we read this article, we had never really come across such a lofty idea. From where does true morality spring? It comes from universal existence. Very, very difficult for us to practice, but that's what Mr. Crosby says. True morality does not depend upon words, phrases, conventions, but upon a universal perception of all things, whereby everything is done for good, every thought and feeling expended for the benefit of others rather than for oneself. True morality is in fact a universal existence, and the beginning of it is in the desire to live to benefit mankind without self-interest or hope of any reward whatever, then to practice and to help those who know still less than we do. We have only 3 minutes, so we won't go on. If there are any questions. What's the connection of having hundreds and thousands of temples with corruption? Because hundreds and thousands of temples, what do people understand by temple? Do we really regard temple as the highest sense in which theosophy speaks about? The temple which is supposed to be that which is supposed to house the deity, and the body of man is also a temple which is actually housing the deity. And going to the temple, going to the pilgrimage is only a reminder to us of a greater pilgrimage. You are going to the divine. You have come back. You have come from the divine and you are going back to the divine. And temple, we may say, is also in a way is a crutch which we require at times when you are not able to fix your faith in emptiness. So you require an idol, and maybe that is what will help you to fix your faith. But apart from that, is temple really teaching you any morals? Of course, if you are really morally pure, then maybe you will question that what am I doing? By going to temple every day, just like a true Christian will say, I go to mass and to the church every day where I am supposed to meet my deity. After coming back day in and day out, why am I not really behaving like one who has deity within him? So, it's only a mechanical external following. So, in spite of having hundreds of temples, we have made those temples, as Jesus used to say, there are money changers who are spoiling really these places which are supposed to be very holy. So, if that is not the idea with which we go to the temple, without understanding its inner significance, we are none the better. For that matter, we may read the scriptures, 108 verses of Gita and so on, which is a step better than going to the temple, and yet we may remain the same. because we have not really imbibed. It is only superficial mechanical following of certain rites and rituals. It is rituals and rites do not really purify you unless and until there is inner. And the other part about, they say you can rob Peter and then give it to other. I think Robin Hood is that kind of a story where he used to rob people and then he used to give it and distribute it amongst the poor. Well, to an extent, it is based on his own understanding. Again, he would say, who is to say whether it is moral or immoral? Mr. Crosby says that it's very difficult to judge an act because each one has his own perspective and point of view. From his level, from his knowledge, he thinks that he is doing good. His idea is only to help the poor. How he does it, he doesn't know. And they say ends justify the means. All these questions are there. So it is for each one to decide. Yeah.
The fourth quotation.
Yeah.
Fourth quotation, the last sentence. In the same way, no one can sell nor suffer the effects of the sin alone.
Yeah.
What I mean from this is, correct me if I'm wrong, does it mean that a person who has sinned, he's got to suffer the consequences of his action along with somebody else? No.
Yeah, in a way. Because, see, the idea is quite broad. We'll tell you what it all means. It's talking basically, this is not the place where we can go much into detail. But when we are really talking about the law of karma, we say that we don't act in isolation. There is something called collective karma. So, if today anybody is suffering, anybody is sinful, then it is not as a result of his own karma, because as we said, we are continually affecting each other. I am knowingly or unknowingly affecting your character. Knowingly or unknowingly, you are affecting my character. Therefore, we all have a hand in making the character of another person. We all have a hand in making the total situation what it is. And therefore, at one place, Mr. Judd says that the indissoluble unity of the race demands that we recognize that the suffering and sin of every individual is partly because of ourselves. We are not able to see this. In this life, I have not done anything. You commit a murder, I've got a hand. Well, I've got some portion of responsibility in that action. Society as a whole has responsibility towards that Ajmal Kasab who has done the act of terrorism. If not in this, then in some past life. The family of that man has got a hand in that, because there is nothing like acting in isolation. I mean, sometimes we've had a whole lecture on this, so this is not the time where we can elaborate. But this is the collective karma. And that is why at one place, Mr. Judge gives us a story where he points out that the king was there and there was his son, the prince. Now, the prince had committed some sin and he had to be punished. So the king says that, the viziers of the king say that there should be a big boulder which should be thrown on his head. Now, it was then decided that if we do this, he won't get a chance to reform himself. And also, let us break it into small, small pieces. Some pieces will be thrown on his head and some pieces will be thrown on his children and grandchildren. And then Mr. Judge goes on to explain. Why so? Because the children and grandchildren would not be born in that family if they did not have a hand in making his character what it was. So, as a result, this is the meaning, he says, in the Bible, where it says, the sins of the father, they visit upon the children and grandchildren. The sins of the father, they visit upon the heads of the children and grandchildren, because the very fact that we are brought together in the same nation, in the same family, shows that we were all party to certain things in the past life. And therefore, we enjoy the advantages together and we also pay for the disadvantages and sins which are committed. We are all affected. If there is a tsunami, many people are affected and they may feel, what did I do? Maybe not in this life, but in some other life. So it's a collective karma, which is what brings this sort of a statement that you are not acting in isolation, which we are not able to see it on the physical plane, unfortunately, but on the unseen plane, we are connected. Time is run out. We have to stop.